This is A Mexican Crossing Lines with Cindy Gomez Shem
and Duke Gomez Shem.
You're listening to 88.1 FM KPPP LP Fargo Moorhead, where we are adding local color to your airwaves. And I want to make a special announcement today on the air on our show, for especially for those who listen to us online.
Yeah.
Because we are doing a drive to stay online.
Yes, yes. There's a we pay royalty fees basically for playing music on the radio station on a terrestrial air. And when you play music on the internet, you have to pay a fee to a place called Sound Exchange. Well, they recently contacted us and said that in order for us to continue streaming our radio station online, we have to pay them $500 up front. And then we have to fill out forms every month, basically with all the songs that were played and who owns them. And then they pay royalties to the musicians, which is not a bad deal.
Of course.
But what it's cost prohibitive for us right now to actually stream online. We're going to continue playing our shows and playing our music on the radio.
Right. You can find all of our old broadcasts on our website as well. So you can go there and check out in podcastable or listenable form to all of our previous shows.
Yeah, we stripped the music off of these shows, and we can still do the Facebook Live, but as far as putting things on the radio, terrestrial air, and giving people an opportunity to listen live to what's on the radio, we have to cease doing that by March 1st.
And that means we need to raise $500 so that we can continue to broadcast online.
Exactly.
Right? If you want to listen live online, send a donation.
Yeah, to go to kpppfm.com /donate, and you can just make a donation straight to the station, and we put that funding to good use.
There's a lot of people that listen to the radio online on their computers at work and on their devices. So if that's your preferred way of listening to our station, please do donate to the People's Press Project by going to our website and clicking on the donate button.
Yep, go to kpppfm.com/donate.
Okay, so I'm also going to make another announcement before we start our show today about our netiquette rules.
Oh, yes.
We do something a lot of people aren't used to. They're not accustomed to having moderators on comment threads, whether it's on YouTube or on newspaper sites, etc. We do. We moderate our content because we are a media station that is a media justice nonprofit. So we look at the dimensions of power in media and also privilege. And we also want to make sure that we give the most marginalized voices in media a first spot at the table, right? A very clear leading position, because this is where the voices of the voiceless get heard. There's plenty of other places where the mainstream or those voices that are in the mainstream have platforms. Our platform is so that the people that are marginalized can get heard, so we don't allow hazing, bullying, threatening, racism, sexism, etc. There is a link that Nemo posts along with this show, so you can look at what our moderator rules are. If you find yourself banned from commenting during a show, it's probably only likely to be that one show, and you'll be allowed to comment again. And you'll probably be warned several times about the offending behavior before you're given the boot.
That's right. You go in timeout, basically.
Yeah, you can still watch the show. You can't comment, aka harass, threaten, etc., other people. If you're caught doing it more than once, you'll probably be banned more than once. And if you're a repeat offender and one that is upsetting to other listeners and viewers a lot of the time, you may be banned permanently. Not of course from watching or listening, but from harassing other people, threatening other people, silencing the voices of other people. So keep that in mind. I just wanted to mention that, and I'll probably be mentioning that at the beginning of all of our shows, because we talk about controversial things that most people in the mainstream don't talk about here on 88.1 FM, which is why you should keep it tuned here, because you're going to get news, information, and programming you're not going to hear anywhere else. Not in the Red River Valley, not in the state of North Dakota, not in Minnesota, you can hear that kind of diversity, but We don't have it here.
That's right. And, you know, we really appreciate that people get a hold of us. You can, you know, tell us what you think about the rules we have, you know. If you appreciate it, if you don't, you can get a hold of us by calling our call-in line, which is 701-566-0917. It's a message line, so it gives you the opportunity to actually say something. And maybe you have a statement, maybe you have something to contribute. We may play it on the air. You have to let us know if that's okay. Also, you can go to our Twitter feed at @media_PPP. You can email Cindy at kpppfm.com or me, Duke, at kpppfm.com. And you can go to our People's Press Project Facebook site. Our 88.1 Fargo-Moorhead is where you're going to find our live streams, and a lot of people tend to comment on that one, too. We mm-hmm. also run another one called Mexi-Can, and Cindy has a public page called at Cindy Go Shemp. So there's lots of ways to get a hold of us, and please communicate with us and keep in touch.
I have a lot of messages and comments from the show we did on Black History. We got an immense response to that. Almost 10,000 people watched and commented on our pre-recording of the broadcast of that show. Really good information in there. And I think you're going to be very pleased tonight with the kind of educational material we're going to be bringing you today.
Great.
It's going to be a very different kind of discussion about gun control. Okay, folks? So let me start off by just mentioning that gun control conversations have always been rather crazy in America.
Yeah.
It's the only topic, really, if you think about it, that can cause people to throw their hands up after the latest slaying of, you know, kids in a school or people at a movie theater or what have you. And people don't have any other thing to say other than, we don't know what happened.
Yeah.
They just throw up their hands. We don't know what happened. We don't know how to solve this problem. Almost every other tragedy that occurs in our consciousness, we do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have types of signs and procedures to stop certain kinds of deaths.
Yeah,
we have,
look at automobiles, you know, all the improvements they made to automobiles and all the different rule changes, because it's something that's lethal force and can kill you, you know, and kill people. And, you know, like you said, people just don't know how to deal with this gun stuff, you know. And it's like, right away, people are, you can't take my guns, you know, and all this stuff. And there's all this misconceptions about the history of weapons and guns in this country. And tonight's show, we're going to go over some of that. So, like you said, there's some really good educational information. I really encourage people to listen before weighing in right away on how they feel about gun issues. But also, we've been trying to deal with solving this. There hasn't really been a dealing with solving it. There's been a pushing it away, not dealing with it through the politicians, through the policies and those sorts of things. There's been some minimal changes, but people keep on going back to the Constitution. And we're going to go back to the Constitution and really look at it tonight.
Right. And we're going to talk about the Second Amendment. Everyone needs to talk about the Second Amendment. But I'm going to give you some racialized perspective from the Mexican crossing lines. That's what I'm here for, right? I'm going to bring it to you and tell you, okay, here's what's really happening behind the gun debate. I haven't seen very many people talk about it, but some people got close. I want to commend them. Here is a Facebook post that came so close to saying what I'm about to tell you is behind this argument. I took the name out. So this is a local person in our area that posted this on Facebook. And I was just like, damn, this is real. This is so true. Okay, they said, when you grow up feeling like due to your race and gender, you're entitled to certain things, and then the universe does not miraculously align to give you those things, so you arm yourself and take out as many members of society in retaliation, what's that mental illness called? Can we give it a name? Possibly white male entitlement syndrome? Can you imagine how many are suffering with it right now? Happy Monday. I was like, ooh. Whoa. I full disclosure, I'm not going to say who that person was. I'm keeping them anonymous, but they were a white person. Before you start sending me your hate mail and your comments about how I'm always pulling the race car, that was a white person. A white person that was talking about white male entitlement. Because let's face it, these mass murderers, these mass shooters are white and male predominantly. We don't have examples of this rampant mass murdering among women. Women of color or white, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't happen. So this is obviously a male problem, and it's obviously got to do with being white, okay? I'm going to go a step further and tell you that, as I have said about many other of society's ills, unless you deal with the race problem, this is not going away. Unless you address the real reason why we do not have gun control, the problem of mass shooters and mass murders will not go away. And the reason we won't deal with this problem is because white people want to retain the right to shoot and kill people of color. Let me repeat that. The right that people waving the Constitution and the Second Amendment and demanding to hold on to their guns, regardless of how deadly they are, the reason that they want to keep their guns is this. They want to retain the right to kill black and brown people at any time that they want without being in any way restrained. They want to retain the right to murder black and brown people and also to control them. Because when you have the power to threaten the life of another person, that is terrorism. I have a gun and I can kill you at any time is a threat, and it is a standing threat where white people are concerned when we're talking about black people. And I'm going to spend the rest of the show backing up what I just said, okay? Because I know I'm a Mexican, so I'm not going to automatically be believed, so I'm going to bring you some receipts. Let's look at the history behind what I'm talking about. Let me show you something that I believe amply proves my point that just happened today. Here's a post by a school board member. Can you make that bigger at the top? What you don't see in this is there's a picture of a noose, and it says, "If we want to make America great again, we will have to make evil people fear punishment again." Now, it's posted, this was posted by Sean King with a statement. Sean King is the former New York Post writer. I think that he is now writing for another publication. I'm not sure which one it is. But it was posted along with an article from theadvocate.com saying that a local Louisiana school board member posted to social media this meme of a noose saying, "If we want to make America great again, we will have to make evil people fear punishment again." But let's break this picture down. Let's break this thing down for a minute. What punishment are they talking about here? They're not talking about, you know, going to jail, right? What punishment are they talking about here?
Obviously, lynching.
And who was historically lynched in this country? Who was punished by lynching in this country? Predominantly black and brown people. So when this school board member hearkens to a time when people feared punishment, he's talking about black and brown people. And what he's talking about bringing back is lynching, which was an extrajudicial form of killing. It went above and beyond due process. And the cops participated. So in response to a school shooting, a massacre by a white student with ties to supremacy groups that had made statements publicly that he wanted to kill Mexicans and N-words and Jews. These are public posts that he made on chat groups in Instagram and I believe in other forms of social media. This is a kid who was deeply disturbed about his relationship to guns, to violence, and he was also abusive of women. He had a girlfriend. He was stated to have abused her and to have beaten her and threatened her if she talked to other people. So we know, because I've done a lot of shows on toxic male masculinity and white supremacy, and I've talked about the fact that these two things intersect and are the, you know, petri dish, which is America, in which we grow all of these terrorists, these white terrorists, very young, a lot of them in their teens and early 20s. This is the profile of these types of serial killers, these types of mass murderers. So one of the places I want to start off is with the Southern Poverty Law Center's article. And it's a very lengthy one. You can go to splcenter.org, the alt-right killing people. The alt-right right is killing people is a very lengthy article that was posted on February 5th of 2018 that has various sections, including the killings and where they started. 2017, a year of alt-right violence, young white angry male, wiring young neurons, not even 21, leaderless resistance, the age of ultraviolence, and the killings to come. And it's very lengthy, but it's also chock full of information. Let me show you this graphic from the article, which gives you a list. And obviously, it hasn't been updated with the latest killer, the shooter from Florida. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty, you know, it's updated all the way through January of 2018, as you can see at the bottom of the of the chart. But it shows you the names and the totals of casualties from these mass shooters in 2017. All of them had ties to the alt-right. Their names: Elliot Roger, age 22. Dylan Roof, age 21. Christopher Sean Chris Harper Mercer, age 26. Alexander Bissonette, age 27. James Harris Jackson, 28. Sean Urbanski, 22. Jeremy Joseph Christian, 35. Lane Maurice Davis, 33. James Alex Fields, 20. William Edward Atchison, 21. Nicholas Giampa, 17. Matthew Real, 37. Samuel Woodward, 20. Their average age is 25.75 years. They killed a total of 43 people. They injured 67 people. So, and again, all of these folks had ties to the alt-right. And if you don't know what the alt-right is, it's the new term for those who are white supremacists, what they used to call skinheads or Nazis. Mm-hmm. They espouse the same ideologies, but they have a new look. Now they carry tiki torches, they wear khakis, and they have those like slightly Hitlerish looking haircuts, you know, they kind of, they look clean. They're your yuppie nationalists, your white supremacist yuppies. And one of the things that this article goes through is the history of where these groups came from, how they quickly gained support through social media and other forms of online groups in chat rooms and things like in Reddit, where folks like this congregate and build support without retribution, without anyone shutting them down, without anyone censoring them. And look, we know that the FBI and law enforcement have been getting infiltrated by white supremacists, and this warning has been coming from the authorities in the government for decades now. We've been ignoring that fact, and we keep getting surprised when we find out that a group of cops was sending racist texts to each other or messages to each other, or that they were calling people that they were shooting N-words or giving orders to new cadets to kill any black people. Hello, this has been a problem for a long time, but we've been ignoring it. So we know that at the recent alt-right protest march that was held somewhere, I think it was in California, the police colluded with the white supremacists to attack people that oppose supremacy and Nazis. Remember I told you that we're in a strange time right now where we can't agree whether it's okay to hate Nazis?
Yeah.
Well, we also live in a time where the police are actually working together with the Nazis to go after the people that oppose Nazis, trying to get them arrested and charged. They tried to charge a man who was stabbed by Nazis and blame him.
Wow.
As the person, they blamed him, saying he had an intent to hurt the supremacists based on the fact that he was wearing something that said Black Lives Matter, or alluding to the fact that he supported Black Lives.
Wow.
That's what time we're living in, mm-hmm. in this country. So it doesn't really surprise me all that much that folks are so reluctant to call white terrorism what it is.
Exactly.
Or that they are unwilling to keep arming these white terrorists in America and keep watching people die to support white supremacy. Because that is what you're doing when you're holding on to those guns.
Mm-hmm.
You want to retain the right to threaten, terrorize, and kill black and brown people to your own deaths, to your own detriment. And I want to show you another graphic. This article is very lengthy. I really recommend that you all go and read it and educate yourself about the history of these alt-right people. So we'll go here to the next graphic. And this other graphic shows you, if I can get to it here, the Americans and their guns. American civilians own more guns per capita than any other nation in the world. Each year, more than 30,000 Americans die by guns. Here in the graphic, this is from the Pew Research Center. This is a 2017 graphic.
Mm-hmm.
This was posted in Al Jazeera. It shows you that personally, people who own guns, there's 30% of people that said that they did, and 70% said they did not. They did not. Know someone who has been shot. 44% of the people polled said that they did, and 56 said they did not. That's an astounding number of people.
It is.
That's nearly half of the people
exactly.
questioned said that they knew someone
who's been
who
shot.
Had been shot.
Yeah. Wow.
Who someone live in a gun-owning household. 42% of people polled said yes. 58% said no. Support stricter gun laws. 52% said yes. That's more than half of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't understand why we can't get something passed.
Exactly.
How many have fired a gun? 72% said yes. So even though only 30% said they personally owned a gun, 72% said they've shot mm-hmm. a gun. Own a gun for protection. 67, this is among gun owners.
Okay.
67% of them said they own that gun for protection. This all comes from an article in Al Jazeera called Gun Control's Racist Past and Present. So I wanted to share this article with you. It walks through the racist history of gun control and why it was mainly used for keeping people of color under control. And there's a little video that they have on here which really illustrates that point. Well, I'm not going to try to rehash it for you. We'll just play it and let you guys learn from the video.
All right.
Gun control in the US has a racist past and present. In fact, most gun control laws throughout history were aimed at preventing black people getting their hands on guns. Here's how. As early as the 1600s, colonies in the States were passing laws that prohibited African Americans from possessing arms. But then the Second Amendment came along in 1791. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. many Americans interpreted this to mean that they, as individuals, had the right to carry guns. Meaning every individual, right? Wrong. Having been emancipated after the Civil War, Southern states passed laws known as Black Codes in 1865 and 1866. Among other things, those laws disarmed former slaves in order to sustain white control. In fact, African Americans were already at a disadvantage. They lost their right to vote in many states because of poll taxes and literacy tests. Exploiting many people's inabilities to read and write, states could further impose gun restrictions. Now fast forward a century to the 1960s. That's when the leaders of the civil rights movement made clear that the need for self-defense still existed. In fact, Martin Luther King Jr. applied for a permit to carry a weapon and was denied. In California, gun control legislation was aimed at preventing groups like the Black Panthers from arming themselves against police. In response, 30 armed Black Panthers marched on the state capitol to protest the legislation in 1967. Not long after, then-Governor Ronald Reagan signed the Mulford Act, prohibiting open carry of weapons in public places. The following year saw the Gun Control Act of 1968, signed by the then-President Richard Nixon. The law banned Saturday night specials, which were the cheaply made handguns associated with crime in minority groups, meaning black communities. Both of these laws were passed by Republicans and supported by the National Rifle Association, one of the most powerful anti-regulation gun lobbies in the USA. The organization continues to advocate for gun owners, though many have criticized the NRA for failing to speak for armed African Americans. So today, why Americans are still more likely to own a gun? And while African Americans' gun ownership is on the rise, black men are 14 times more likely to be shot and killed than white men. So even though almost anyone can apply for a gun permit today, systematic racial bias in the US means that gun control remains a divisive issue.
Divisive. Deadly.
Deadly.
Deadly, yes. And not just divisive. Wow.
You know, and, you know, going back to that Southern Poverty Law Center graphic about the killers, the mass murderers, like Atchison and Rogers from that list, these perpetrators are all male, and with the exception of three men, all of them were under the age of 30 at the time that they committed these killings. The average age of these people was 26 years old. The youngest one was 17 years old.
I see that.
One of them, Alexander Bissonnette, Canadian. But the rest are all Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And while some certainly did show some kinds of signs of mental illness, all of them had a history of consuming and or participating in the type of far-right ecosystem that defines the alt-right. They were involved in groups or conversations or a supporting of supremacy, white supremacy and Nazis and all of those things that those people espouse. And that is troubling because what it shows is what I've been saying.
Mm-hmm.
These people are letting it all hang out and telling you the reason why they go on these mass shootings is to put people, black people, in their place.
Yep.
And that is at the, you know, that's part of the angst that these white supremacists have. The white supremacists want to be heard because they feel like during this economic recession that we have been experiencing pretty much since I was born, the upward mobility and the, you know, increase in success of most white Americans over my lifetime has not equaled or surpassed the generation of their parents.
Mm.
And so in that kind of an economic atmosphere, what have white people been taught to do? Find the black scapegoat,
mm-hmm,
the whipping boy. And you go after them. And Trump dog whistles this beautifully to Americans, and yep, people believe it. Oh, it's the black people. It's the Muslims. It's Black Lives Matter. They're the extremist terrorists. They're the immigrants from Mexico. Those people are the ones that are dangerous in America. I want to direct you to some study a study. This is from a university paper from the University of Washington, which goes into more depth about the role of the intersectional identities in mass murder incidents, and which argues that young white males' unique downward social mobility relative to his expectations accounts for their overrepresentation as perpetrators of mass murder. Today's typical mass murderer, I'm quoting from the study, is not simply a white man with all the trappings of pride and privilege granted within the context of gender and race relations in the United States. His privileged white racial identity does not necessarily save him from the diminished socioeconomic status of downward mobility, nor does his privileged male gender guarantee the dominance of hegemonic masculinity over others. In fact, it is the very entitlement of his race and gender which makes any subsequent life course struggle and failure all the more unexpected, and thus all the more painful and humiliating. Modfis also points out that privileged white males are often the least equipped to deal with these unexpected setbacks in life. A lack of experience with failure due to relative privilege leaves young white middle-class males uniquely unprepared to cope with difficulty or any kind of loss in their life. Here is more from that. I really think you should all go read the whole thing.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to give you some juicy excerpts that that kind of give you some meat and potatoes of what's in this. I didn't even get to the homophobia of white males that is also intertwined with their mass murderiness, having to do with their white supremacy and the white fragility. I told you, white fragility and white supremacy is the cause of all evil in this world. And the paper is called Triple Entitlement and Homicidal Anger, an exploration of the intersectional identities of American mass murderers. The PDF is available for download. We will have a link for you. Let's bring up that graphic and I'll share an excerpt.
All right.
This is an excerpt from Triple Entitlement and Homicidal Anger, an exploration of the intersectional identities of American mass murderers. We have a link available with this. This is from February 19, 2018, when I accessed it, of a study done by Eric Madifus from the Social Work Department and the Department of Criminal Justice at the University of Tacoma, Washington. Here's part of the introduction. Mass murder is by no means a new phenomenon, but recent tragedies at a public meeting with Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in Tucson, Arizona, at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, at an elementary school in Newton, Connecticut, and at a mall in Portland, Oregon, have led both the media and public to be increasingly aware of this particularly heinous crime. This article investigates the dynamic of race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, gender, sexual orientation, and age in an attempt to bring additional clarity toward understanding the motivations of American mass killers. Frame the intersectional approach and the literature, the convergence of various demographic categories offers new insight into this uniquely violent population. Such an intersectional approach includes the consideration of 1. White entitlement, 2. Middle class instability and downward mobility in the post-industrial economy, and 3. Heterosexual masculinity and its relationship to violence. Heterosexual middle-class white men in their teenage years and in middle age commit mass murder, but few other violent crimes, in numbers disproportionately high relative to their share of the population. This has led Gloria Steinem, in 1999, to call mass murder, along with serial killing, supremacy crimes in terms of race, gender, class, and sexuality. Through the theoretical lens of intersectionality, these identity characteristics and any possible criminal motivations associated with them will be explored via their convergences and divergences. Intersectionality stresses the importance of looking at how various identities interact. Yet the literature on intersectionality is both largely theoretical, McCall 2007, and focuses almost entirely on those oppressed via racism, sexism, homophobia, imperialism, capitalism, and so on. This article will instead look at the benefactors of patriarchy, racism, and heterosexism through crucially not post-industrial capitalism, in order to stress how white heterosexuality, coordinated masculinity, and other disappointing life course events in a way that drives some anguished individuals to retaliate in true hegemonic masculine form through large-scale acts of retaliatory violence and murder. In this unique intersectional context, the performance of a violent massacre provides an illegitimate opportunity to entitle white men to regain lost status and forge a powerful, successful masculine identity through infamy. The vast majority of studies of mass murder have either not addressed the impact of identity or have done so peripherally and without theoretical depth. While Layton, 2001, discusses social class and political economy, Weiss, in 2001, focuses upon race, ethnicity, and Collier, in 1998, Mai, and Alpert, in 2000, and Aroni, in 2000, addressed gender masculinity. All of these authors have focused upon the impact of a singular component of identity. The few studies which seem to have acknowledged the importance of intersecting identities exclusively concern themselves with school shootings, a particular subset of mass murder, Levin and Madfi's 2009. School shootings, the tragedy at Columbine School in particular, have been analyzed through the converging lenses of race and gender. Shealy and Stewart, 2001, Konzlavo, 2003. They fused vantage points and homophobia, masculinity, and socioeconomic status, Klein, 2006, and via the amalgam of homophobia, masculinity, race, and political ideology, Kimmel and Mahler, 2003. Aitken, in 2001, looks at school shooters' demographic traits and the intersections of racism, sexism, and ageism though this study explores how moral panics over such shootings develop rather than as a means of understanding the etiology. Despite these initial forays into the intersectional identities of school shooters, no study has yet addressed intersectionality and mass murder more generally. Here are some excerpts from different sections of the book. This on anti-racist activist Tim Weiss, published in 2005, page 135, describing that while violence committed by African Americans, quote, always gets viewed through the lens of race, as in what's wrong with black people or that underclass, which is white folk code language for black people. Violence by whites, whether kids or middle class stockbrokers who wipe out their entire families because they lost their job, is never viewed this way. It is never viewed as racial, as somehow signifying something about the group and its genetic or culturally ingrained flaws. Here is another section about the same topic. Being the dominant group can set you up for a fall, can prevent you from building up the kinds of coping skills needed to deal with setback, because so often these skills are ones you just don't need. White men are not systematically disenfranchised, and so they have not built up the requisite psychological and emotional mechanisms for dealing with loss. One of the white American men in his book states that, quote, when one is top dog, one has the luxury of not really worrying all that much about the consequences of our actions. And 9 times out of 10, that works out okay for us. Our behaviors don't lead to catastrophe, be it personal or communal. But all it takes is that one time to demonstrate the limits of our privilege. Similarly, Weiss, in 2005, pages 140 through 141, describes another young white male as saying, I never realized how messed up it could be being a white male. I was raised and encouraged to always see myself as being in control, in charge, stable, together. That's how white men are portrayed, and that's the stuff I ingested from the time I was a kid. It wasn't you and your dad's fault. It's just the constant message I got growing up. Always be in control. Always win. And then, when a few things went wrong, I couldn't deal with it. I didn't know how to cope, because I'd never had to cope with anything before. Weiss goes on to assert that whites experience a serious feeling of emptiness as a result of their own lost ethnicity, particularly when faced with the multiculturalism of others. They fill this void with privilege upon which they have become dependent. In her interviews with white students, McKinney, 2005, finds that her respondents frequently feel their privileged status is threatened and that their chances at success have been significantly diminished. Many students in her study construct their whiteness to be a cultural and economic disadvantage through personal stories of victimization. She states that, quote, it's difficult for young white people to conceive of their whiteness as a privilege when it is consistently presented to them in everyday and political discourse as a liability. McKinney, 2005, page 151. This conclusion, however, inaccurate, allows white people to feel like blameless victims or, excuse me, this conclusion, however inaccurate, allows whites to feel like blameless victims of affirmative action and reverse racism rather than the gleeful recipients of an inheritance of white privilege. The externalization of blame has been cited as a predisposing psychological trait of mass murderers, Fox and Levin, 1998 and 99. Interestingly enough, from McKinney's analysis, it seems that the externalization of blame, at least in the sense of always perceiving oneself as a victim and never as the culprit, may be a widely prevalent rationalization and commonplace in mainstream white society. When mass killers also exhibit this symptom, it may be an artifact of their racial upbringing and situation in the American hierarchical structure. So there you have it. I mean, and I love me some Tim Weiss.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff from him in there. And it always kills me, you know, when I mention, you know, Robin DiAngelo's work and talk about white fragility and white privilege. White fragility is a term that was coined by a white professor, a mm-hmm. white anti-racism trainer. Her name is Robin DiAngelo. You can go and look her up. I'm not lying. She calls herself a white woman. So I'm just repeating what she calls herself. And people get really hung up about that. But these folks have already studied why white people have such a problem in dealing with this. And because white people do not want to examine their institutional role in upholding white supremacy or look at their privilege and how they continue to benefit from the oppression of people of color, we can't have a serious discussion about sexism, rape culture, or gun control. Mm-hmm. We can't have any discussion that in some way intersects with white power, white male power. And this has been so clearly illustrated to me, because I got to say, so when the Black Lives Matter movement was, you know, like, in its heyday, in its marches every other day, marches every other week that was going on all over the country. And there was this real stark difference between those that supported Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. and those who opposed it. The people that supported Black Lives Matter were like, yes, black people finally need to have human dignity, you know. And the people that opposed it were like, run them over with your car.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's like, horrible.
They hate the cops. They're hunting the cops.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are black identity extremists. You know, like that kind of rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was a sign of what really is driving the opposition to Black Lives Matter, which is hating black people, mm-hmm. white supremacy, and the killing and oppression of black people, the enslavement of black people. That's why you don't like it, because you're essentially a grand wizard of the KKK, mm-hmm. and that's why you want to run them over. So that's how I felt about, you know, that whole, this whole movement, which is still going on. When the Me Too thing came out,
yeah,
you had all of these people, women of color and white women, they were all talking about rape culture and consent, and men lost their minds. Mm-hmm. And then we started to have a discussion about how women of color have been saying this is a problem for us for a long time, and nobody cared until some white ladies in Hollywood started saying they're going through it too. And the Me Too hashtag was started by a black woman a decade ago, right? So there was a discussion about rape culture, but when we tried to start having a discussion about the intersectionality of race mm-hmm. and rape culture and abuse and what the differences are between white women and the way that black women are marginalized and sexually abused in a culture that feels that black women are not the standard of beauty, that black women should be ostracized in terms of, you know, like their right to have their children, to raise their families. And also the way in which black and black trans women's sexual assaults are kind of swept under the rug.
Oh, yeah.
Missing black women mm-hmm. in the 30 some thousand missing black women in America. Nobody's looking for these women. Mm-hmm. So all of these things have been kind of put under the category. You know, we're trying to fight against racism with Black Lives Matter, but it's thwarted by those who want to hold on to racism and slavery.
Yeah.
We want to talk about ending rape culture and male misogyny, but we can't have a serious discussion about this because everyone is getting bent out of shape if black women and brown women are demanding the same visibility.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're talking about gun rights.
Yeah.
And you have people that are using Make America Great Again. They're talking about the noose.
Yeah.
Can you put up that graphic of this Louisiana school board member? These are people talking about gun control, and they're talking about very clearly lynching black people. There's a reason why this board member used a noose
mm-hmm.
and a meme that says, if we want to make America great again, we will have to make evil people fear punishment again. Well, the people that were punished with nooses and lynched were black and brown people.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see people defending those guns, a lot of those people are MAGA wearing, hat wearing, you know, Trump supporters. And there is a really great article in The Atlantic on the origins of the public carry jurisprudence that talks about slavery, the Second Amendment, slave state origins of modern gun rights. Here it is. I suggest that you go check it out. There's a reason why gun advocates, you know, wanted to allow people to carry guns. And it has to do with the slave states and their right to protect themselves from people they might get into a fight with, and also to get a hold of slaves and control them and kill them if necessary. The right to be able to kill black people whenever they want to. I'm going to read you an excerpt from this section, or I'm going to have my intern do it. We're on number 8 here. Just read to the end of here, of the number 8. Here's an excerpt from The Atlantic.
Gun rights advocates have waged a relentless battle to gut what remains of Americans' lax and inadequate gun regulations. In the name of the Second Amendment, they are challenging the constitutionality of state and municipal may issue regulations that restrict the right to carry weapons in public to persons who can show a compelling need to be armed. A few courts are starting to take these challenges seriously, but what the advocates do not acknowledge, and some courts seem not to understand, is that their arguments are grounded in precedent unique to the violent world of the slaveholding South. Public carry advocates like to cite historical court opinions to support their constitutional vision, but those opinions are, to put it mildly, highly problematic. The supportive precedent they rely on comes from the antebellum South and represented less a national consensus than a regional exception rooted in the unique culture of slavery and honor. By focusing only on sympathetic precedent and ignoring the national picture, gun rights advocates find themselves venerating a moment at which slavery, honor, violence, and public carrying of weapons were intertwined. The opinion most enthusiastically embraced by public carry advocates is Nunn v. State, a state court decision written by Georgia Chief Justice Joseph Henry Lumpkin in 1846. As a jurist, Lumpkin was a champion both of slavery and of the Southern Code of Honor. Perhaps not by coincidence, Nunn was the first case in which a court struck down a gun law on the basis of the Second Amendment. The U.S. Supreme Court cited Nunn in the District of Columbia versus Heller, its landmark 2008 decision holding, for the first time in over 200 years, that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess a handgun in the home for self-defense. Why courts or gun rights advocates think Lumpkin's view of the right to bear arms provides a solid foundation for modern firearms jurisprudence is puzzling. Slavery, honor, and their associated violence spawned a unique weapons culture. One of its defining features was a permissive view of white citizens' right to carry weapons in public. As early as 1840, antebellum historian Richard Hindlebreth observed that violence was frequently employed in the South both to subordinate slaves and to intimidate abolitionists. In the South, violence was frequently employed in South both to subordinate slaves and to intimidate abolitionists. In the South, violence was also an approved way to avenge perceived insults to manhood and personal status. Southern men thus carried weapons both as a protection against the slaves and also to be prepared for quarrels between free men.
Wow, I think about my history with guns. I, grew up in the Midwest, and there's a lot of kids had guns. They all had rifles, and I remember we had a .22 rifle in our house, and we were allowed to take it and shoot targets if we had training. And my brother had training from the NRA; he got a sharpshooter medal, in fact. And I was like so proud of my brother that he had this gun training, and then he trained me, and I think about no historical context of where guns come from. And I never thought of that gun as there to protect us from anything. It was something to shoot with. But I do go back to fifth grade when one of my, one of the sisters, one of the nuns that was my teacher said, the Russians are coming. Oh. The Russians are coming by Christmas.
Oh God.
And I remember my little fifth grader head kind of going, well, we need to protect ourselves. And I imagined having sandbags in front of her house. And I told my mom, we need to get a whole bunch of more bullets because the Russians are coming. And so his little fifth grader was
holy
like,
God, you were getting ready to go to war against the Russians?
I was because I was really scared.
As a fifth grader?
As a fifth grader. And, I think about how that affected. I don't have a gun.
I'm certainly glad you don't.
I'm one of those 72% who shot a gun.
You know, I don't want you jumping the gun like you wanted to back then. Like, grab the gun.
Grab the gun. You know, and I don't want a gun in the house. I think that, you know, a lot of people get killed and hurt by guns.
Yeah.
In their own house, I've met people who got their hands shot off because they're reaching for a gun or cleaning the gun, shot themselves in the chest, these sorts of things. And, you know, just shooting somebody because they're freaked out and they shoot their neighbor when they're bringing over some tortillas or something, you know. It's like, bam, neighbor gone.
Yeah, we don't like guns. I've never wanted to have a handgun in my home. I don't like being places where guns are. They freak me out. I believe that they are possessed by Satan and that they could go off and kill me at any moment.
Yeah.
So I don't like having them around.
Mm-hmm.
I know how to shoot a gun. My family owned guns. And so I'm all good. I don't like the guns. I don't want them around. And again, I want to emphasize that my particular feeling about this is that very clearly there is a control aspect, a keeping people in their place aspect. The idea that many of the people who are gun owners, which is in a majority white men.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget that when black people, the Black Panthers in particular, started getting armed and defending themselves and showing up in public places armed, carrying, open carrying, the government and the NRA approved gun control law. It was the first time that anyone cared to do this. This was under Reagan that that this happened. Why was everyone so quick to agree we needed gun control? Because the people that are not supposed to have guns are the people you're controlling with the guns.
Mm-hmm.
And these militias, the slave catchers. Who are the slave catchers of today? The cops, immigration, Border Patrol, U.S. Marshals, the Army,
mm-hmm.
all those people with guns. Those are the people that are the slave enforcers. They're the ones that are the supremacy enforcers. And, you know, the biggest, most interesting thing that's come out of this for me as somebody watching from a distance is to see how many people are already coming up with these crazy, like, it's a discussion that is 50 different directions.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, he has mental illness. Now people are fighting about mental illness, mm-hmm. and whether or not he really does have mental illness. And then there's conversations about whether or not he has fetal alcohol syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
And there are conversations about whether or not he was really connected to the alt-right or not, and how much, and whether or not, you know, he wanted to kill Jews and Mexicans, or he's just a violent lunatic that likes to shoot guns and would kill white people just as easily and doesn't really care about that. Was, you know, like whether or not this was racially motivated is one of those things, like, you know, nobody wants to acknowledge. But there are so many other things that are being discussed, like whether or not the students are trained by Democrats, whether or not the students are children of the FBI, and somehow they're trying to undermine the presidency of Donald Trump.
Oh, it's a setup. It's a setup, yes.
That some of these kids are crisis actors, like the crisis actors they've used at other mass shootings, which are also supposedly false flags. There's all these crazy conspiracy theories where people are actually already, okay? There have not even been funerals for all of these dead children yet.
Mm-hmm.
And there are already people circulating conspiracy theories on the internet saying that these people didn't really die. Wow. That the people that are on TV crying about their dead friends at school are actually actors. That they're fake people too, or political plants. It's crazy.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think about it and I'm like, oh my God, is this manufactured stupidity? Is this manufactured, like, multiple personality disorder so that you don't actually have to address the fact that there's dying bodies strewn all over this country because of these mass murders? Is that what you're doing to yourself, America? Because it feels like this kind of like tortured logic that only someone that really did not want to solve this problem would do in response to a very obvious problem. And this is A Mexican Crossing Lines with Cindy Gomez-Shem.
And Duke Gomez-Shem.
You're listening to 88.1 FM KPPP LP Fargo-Moorhead, where we are adding local color to your airwaves. Part of that has to do with the fact that we don't want to deal with the racism that is behind all of this. And we don't want to actually look at the root of the things that people dog whistle out of their mouths all the time, like Second Amendment rights. You know, when you hear Trump say law and order, he's hearkening back to the time when they were calling for law and order to punish black people and brown people, just like that noose and that meme. It's time to crack down on the black people and the brown people. When they say, a politician says, I'm going to be tough on crime, they're saying, I'm going to hurt black and brown people. Does that make y'all happy? Vote for me. I will put the black people in jail. When they say they're going to build the wall, these things have now even become like racial slurs. These are things that people chant at games to humiliate black and brown students. These are the kinds of dog whistling messages that are actually stating racism, supremacy, and hate. That is what I see behind all of this gun control talk. And unless we can talk about that, I don't think we're going to get anywhere near dealing with the reason why we keep all these guns around.
Exactly.
Because it isn't for protection. And it isn't because a good guy with a gun can save bad guy, stop bad guys with guns. And it isn't because we have to stop our government from tyranny of the government. They have a lot more weapons than you do or ever will amass, and you can't stop them. None of the reasons why people that are clinging to the guns is the real reason why they want to keep the guns. It's the reason I'm telling you. And no one will ever admit that out loud. But there was this one great little video that someone did after one of the many millions of mass shootings that goes on in America a year or two ago. I believe it was last year, where he went to a gun store right after some mass shooting that occurred and wanted to ask them, why do they sell these guns? Why do they feel like they need to sell these, heavy military grade, like multiple murder type shooter things? And they said, look, the real reason they make a lot of money off of these guns, but the real reason he said that people buy them was they're afraid of the coming race war. Every time they watch black people go marching in the streets over the latest dead black person that was shot by cops, they get scared and they go buy more guns so they can be ready for the race war. So when the black people rise up and say, enough is enough, we're tired of being murdered, we're tired of being slaves, they have a gun to get those slaves under control. And as we have seen, the police and militarized police, they're ready to do it. They showed us. Native Americans stood up for their water rights in Standing Rock, and they pounded them with water cannons and LRAPs and MRAPs and rubber bullets and everything they could could throw at them. Black people stood up in protest against the killing of innocent, unarmed black people, and we got the same thing in America, all over the place. That's what this is about. Here is an article that will give you the history behind the Second Amendment. And
there's another video that we didn't
play. Oh, that's right. Let's show the other video first. Thank you for keeping me on.
And this track. One kind of sums up a lot of the stuff you've been talking about.
Yes.
But here we go.
Thank you.
Comes to the stats on gun deaths, the United States is in a league of its own. But here's three things you may not be aware of when it comes to the politics behind the gun control debate in the US. First, did you know that the much-cited Second Amendment...
I am extremely pro-Second Amendment.
...has provided an individual right to bear arms for only the last seven of the country's 239-year history. Yep, prior to a very controversial Supreme Court ruling in 2008, most US Supreme Court justices and attorneys general going back more than two centuries agreed that the Second Amendment was about protecting military or militia activities rather than, say, disturbed young men trying to buy assault rifles at gun shows. Former Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger called the so-called Second Amendment objection to gun control one of the greatest pieces of fraud on the American people by any special interest group. Burger was referring, of course, to the National Rifle Association, the NRA. But did you know that up until the 1970s, the NRA wasn't all that interested in gun rights and more interested in gun safety and, yes, even gun control? In fact, while this is what the NRA boss says now...
American gun owners... will never surrender our Second Amendment freedom, period.
This is what the NRA president told Congress back in 1934. Carrying guns should be sharply restricted and only under licenses. So basically, the NRA doesn't agree with the NRA. Third, most US conservatives these days are quick to invoke their hero, former President Ronald Reagan.
I'm a Reagan conservative.
But did you know, and do they know, that Reagan, who remember was shot in the chest in 1981, backed gun control in 1991. In fact, earlier as governor of California, Reagan signed into law a 15-day waiting period on handgun sales. What a traitor. The reality is, Reagan quite liked the idea of background checks, the NRA hasn't always opposed gun control, and the Second Amendment hasn't always meant what people think it means.
Wow, they brought up the thing of in the 60s that the NRA was doing gun safety and they showed a little kid.
Yeah.
But it was all training. It was all training because it's been the training. This idea that people can carry guns around in this country, you know, it's there's a gun shop right out about a mile from here, out on Highway 10, right next to the rent car place.
Yeah,
and I went out there, and it's a new gun shop, and what I noticed is that it's well lit and has guns lining the wall, all sorts of assault rifles and guns everywhere, and in front, it has these poles that they put in the cement poles, steel poles, all in front of this gun shop.
What? Yeah, for why?
To keep people from ramming their car in there and taking all the guns. The gun shops are worried about getting robbed by people who want to steal the guns. And the guy was out there smoking a cigarette, and he had a gun strapped to his hip, you know, and I'm just looking around like, damn, when did you guys move here, you know, and he's just like looking at me. So, you know, that's right in our neighborhood, and there's plenty of gun shops around.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's horrifying. I didn't want to know that. Now I'm like going to be freaked out that there's a gun shop by me. That's awful. And I suppose in North Dakota, it's even worse because they're gun happy over there.
Oh, yeah.
Man, they love their guns in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
But Minnesota does too. I mean, who are we kidding here?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we're not that different.
Nope.
We just have more lakes, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, and they were saying Second Amendment. They dog whistle these phrases. These phrases carry significant racialized weight, okay? Let's not kid ourselves. That's what we're really not talking about in this gun control debate, that everyone keeps coming up with excuses for not addressing. And... the Second Amendment is probably one of the most hotly debated out of all of these. I did a lot of studying and writing and discussing the racist history of the Tea Party and all of their Second Amendment BS and what they're all about. And there's this great book out there or resource material that I used back in the day when I was talking about it. I wonder if I can find that old podcast and rebroadcast it. You'll have to help me try to find the shows that I did about the Tea Party and their history, because it talks all about the Second Amendment stuff. And that's where I was like, I learned how they were trying to ratify the Constitution and what the battles were in those early days when the states were like... really like reforming the Constitution and the original papers, the documents that are foundational to this country's creation, and what they were afraid of and what those things meant at the time. What is a standing militia? What was going, why did people have a problem with that kind of thing? And what I learned was a lot of it had to do with slaves. I mean, most of it had to do with slaves. Also, you know, the idea, the separation from the British crown, the idea that you didn't want redcoats being sent anywhere near your house, and you just have to have soldiers at your house and you have to allow them to be in your house. They didn't want those kinds of infringements on their freedom. So at the time when the foundation of this country was happening, there was a lot of mistrust between the northern states and the southern states and how centralized government was going to take away rights of the states to maintain the status quo of slavery in particular, but other things too, but mostly slavery. I mean, if I hear another white person say that the Civil Rights War was fought over states' rights, I'm going to scream.
The Civil War?
Yeah, the Civil War. Excuse me. So it's important for us to really learn the history behind these things. And since nobody else is going to teach it to you, I will tell you here on Mexican Crossing Lines. Let's bring up the next graphic for the truth out. The Second Amendment was ratified to preserve slavery. This is from Truth Out, dated January 15, 2013, by Tom Hartman. The real reason the Second Amendment was ratified, and why it says state instead of country, the framers knew the difference, see the Tenth Amendment, was to preserve the slave patrol militias in the southern states, which was necessary to get Virginia's vote. Founders Patrick Henry, George Mason, and James Madison were totally clear on that, and we all should be too. In the beginning, there were the militias in the South. They were called the slave patrols, and they were regulated by the states. In Georgia, for example, a generation before the American Revolution, laws were passed in 1755 and 1757 that required all plantation owners or their male white employees to be members of the Georgia militia, and for those armed militia members to make monthly inspections of the quarters of all slaves in the state. The law defined which counties had which armed militias and even required armed militia members to keep a keen eye out for slaves who may be planning uprisings. As Dr. Carl T. Bogus wrote for the University of California Law Review in 1998, quote, "The Georgia statutes required patrols under the direction of commissioned militia officers to examine every plantation every month and authorize them to search all Negro houses for offensive weapons and ammunition, and to apprehend and give 20 lashes to any slave found outside plantation grounds." It's the answer to the question raised by the character played by Leonardo DiCaprio in Django Unchained when he asked, "Why don't they just rise up and kill the whites?" If the movie were real, it would have been purely a rhetorical question, because every Southerner of the era knew the simple answer. Well-regulated militias kept the slaves in chains. Sally E. Hayden, in her book, Slave Patrols, Law and Violence in Virginia and the Carolinas, notes that although eligibility for the militia seemed all-encompassing, not every middle-aged white male Virginian or Carolinian became a slave patroller. There were exemptions so that men in critical professions, like judges, legislators, and students, could stay at their work. Generally, though, she documents how most Southern men between ages of 18 and 45, including physicians and ministers, had to serve on slave patrols in the militia at one time or another in their lives. A slave rebellion was keeping, and slave rebellions were keeping the slave patrols busy. By the time the U.S. Constitution was ratified, hundreds of substantial slave uprisings had occurred across the South. Blacks outnumbered whites in large areas, and the state militias were used to both prevent and to put down slave uprisings. As Dr. Bogus points out, slavery can only exist in the context of a police state, and the enforcement of that police state was the explicit job of the militias. If the anti-slavery folks in the North had figured out a way to disband or even move out of the state, those Southern militias, the police state of the South, would have collapsed. And similarly, if the North were to invite into militia service the slaves of the South, they could be emancipated, which would collapse the institution of slavery and the Southern economic and social system altogether. These two possibilities worried Southerners like James Monroe and George Mason, who owned more than 300 slaves, and the Southern Christian evangelical Patrick Henry, who opposed slavery on principle, but also opposed freeing slaves. Their main concern was that Article 1, Section 8 of the newly proposed U.S. Constitution, which gave the federal government the power to raise and supervise a militia, could also allow the federal militia to subsume their state militias and change them from slave enforcing institutions into something that could even one day free the slaves. This was not an imagined threat. Famously, 12 years earlier, during the lead up to the Revolutionary War, Lord Dunsmore offered freedom to slaves who could escape and join his forces. Liberty to slaves was stitched on their jacket pocket flaps. During the war, British General Henry Clinton extended this practice in 1779. Numerous freed slaves served in General Washington's army. Thus, Southern legislators and plantation owners lived not just in fear of their own slaves rebelling, but also in fear that their slaves could be emancipated through military service. And the ratifying convention in Virginia in 1788, Henry laid it out, quote, "Let me here call your attention to that part, Article 1, Section 8 of the proposed Constitution, which gives the Congress power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. By this, sir, you see that their control over our last and best defense is unlimited. If they neglect or refuse to discipline or arm our militia, they will be useless. The states can do neither, this power being exclusively given to Congress. The power of appointing officers over men not disciplined or armed is ridiculous, so that this pretended little remains of power left to the many to the states may, at the pleasure of Congress, be rendered negatory." And George Mason expressed a similar fear. Quote, "The militia may be here destroyed by that method which has been practiced in other parts of the world before, that is, by rendering them useless, by disarming them. Under various pretenses, Congress may neglect to provide for arming and disciplining the militia, and the state governments cannot do it, for Congress has an exclusive right to arm them under this proposed Constitution." Henry then bluntly laid it out, quote, "If the country be invaded, a state may go to war, but cannot suppress slave insurrections under this Constitution. If there should happen an insurrection of slaves, the country cannot be said to be invaded. They cannot therefore suppress it with the interposition of Congress. Congress and Congress only under this new Constitution can call forth the militia." And why was that such a concern for Patrick Henry? This is what he said. Quote, in this state, he said, there are 236,000 blacks, and there are as many in several other states. But there are few or none in the northern states. May Congress not say that every black man must fight? Did we not see a little of this last war? We were not so hard pushed as to make emancipation general, but acts of assembly passed that every slave who would go to the army should be free. Patrick Henry was also convinced that the power over the various state militias given the federal government in the new Constitution could be used to strip the slave states of their slave patrol militias. He knew the majority attitude in the North opposed slavery, and he worried that they'd use the Constitution to free the slaves, the South's slaves, a process then called manumission. The abolitionists would, he was certain, use that power, and ironically, this is pretty much what Abraham Lincoln ended up doing, quote, they will search that paper, the Constitution, and see if they have power of manumission, said Henry. And have they not, sir? Have they not power to provide for the general defense and welfare? May they not think that these call for the abolition of slavery? May they not pronounce all slaves free? And will they not be warranted by that power? This is no ambiguous implication or logical deduction. The paper speaks to the point. They have the power in clear, unequivocal terms and will clearly and certainly exercise it. He added, this is a local matter, and I can see no propriety in subjecting it to the Congress. James Madison, the father of the Constitution and a slaveholder himself, basically called Patrick Henry paranoid, saying, I was struck with surprise when I heard him express himself alarmed with respect to the emancipation of slaves. There is no power to warrant it in that paper, the Constitution. If there be, I know it not. But the Southern fears wouldn't go away. Patrick Henry even argued that Southerners' property, slaves, would be lost under the new Constitution and the resulting slave uprisings would be less than peaceful or tranquil. Quote, in this situation, Henry said to Madison, I see a great deal of the property of the people of Virginia in jeopardy and their peace and tranquility gone. So Madison, who at Jefferson's insistence already began to prepare proposed amendments to the U.S. Constitution, changed his first draft of one that addressed the militia issue to make sure that it was unambiguous to Southern states that the Southern states could maintain their slave patrol militias. His first draft for what became the Second Amendment had said, quote, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country, but no person religiously scrupulous or being armed or bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person. But Henry Madison and others wanted Southern states to preserve their slave patrol militias independent of the federal government. And so, Madison changed the word country to the word state, and he redrafted the Second Amendment into today's form. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
So there is a clear connection between holding on to slave patrols to control black people, to control slaves, and the violence that we see today against people of color. The attacks by Nicholas Cruz were in part based in his, you know, white supremacist ideas,
mm-hmm.
and also his violent tendency toward women. This is something that we see repeatedly again and again, yeah. with these mass shooters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know that the idea that I am putting forth here, which is that you have to look beneath the surface of the conversation about gun control and look at the racial aspects of why we have guns and what they're used to control, who they're used to control and yep. kill. I believe that it is essential to actually dismantling the use of guns,
mm-hmm.
Not only in, you know, the American populace, but also in our policing.
Yes.
Because I've also connected it to that. And one of our listeners sent me various articles in which they were looking at the connections between the training that Nicholas Cruz got at school,
mm-hmm.
through the ROTC or JROTC and the NRA.
Yeah.
And they also started sending me articles about how these programs are put in the schools, and they basically indoctrinate the shooters. You know, they indoctrinate mm-hmm. and train mass killers in America. And there's an article on worldbeyondwar.org about this that we can share with our audience. An excerpt of it reads as follows: JROTC programs in the U.S. are run by the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. The school shooting programs are regulated by the Civilian Marksmanship Program.
Hmm.
The program was set up by Congress after the Spanish-American War,
wow.
to ensure that large numbers of Americans knew how to shoot guns in the event of a war. The CMP is now a private entity with $160 million in assets. It sells discarded military rifles, pistols, and ammunition to the American public at the behest of Congress. The CMP downplays the health and safety concerns of the robust shooting program. Each branch has its own curriculum and textbooks that teach a dangerous and reactionary version of American history. The U.S. bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki to save 1 million American lives. The North Vietnamese fired on an innocent American warship in the Gulf of Tonkin. History is taught as a kind of American fait accompli. American exceptionalism and the use of force as an instrument of foreign policy are enshrined values next to accepting one's place in the chain of command. The civics textbook has a unit entitled You the People rather than We the People.
Wow.
Schools exercise no curricular oversight. School districts across the country are allowing this intellectual straitjacket of a program to substitute for the arts. In addition, Broward's schools host several dozen other military programs that work with the recruiting command to provide leads for recruiters for the
mm-hmm.
military.
Mm-hmm.
The military has also infiltrated the social media networks of high school children. And it talks about the Stoneman Douglas High School marksmanship program in here. So it's a good article that you know, covers the connections. I would say there's an even deeper connection between how children are indoctrinated in school, period.
Yeah.
Not just with military training. And I would venture to guess that the majority of the children that are put into these JROTC programs are white children. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't think that they're training a bunch of black and brown kids to shoot guns in the high schools.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
Mm-mm.
And I also believe that the way that children are indoctrinated in our schools to be subjugated to white students and white authority is part of the school-to-prison pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the, you know, subjugation of people of color, the mm-hmm. training that people mm-hmm. of color are put through when they're still kids all the way through high school, if they even make it through, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I would argue that not just these guns, but also the racialized aspect of how children are mistreated in schools. And I've done a lot of shows about the abuses that go on in the school systems all over America, specifically targeting people of color and people with other, you know, protected statuses. And I'm going to be bringing you such a story next time on A Mexican Crossing Lines. It is the story of a young man who was assaulted at Fargo North High School.
Oh, yeah.
His name is Christopher Thumb. And we're going to be showing you the violent and vicious attack that took place against Christopher in the varsity boys locker room, where he was lured. And it is going to be something that is shocking and incredibly disturbing. Not only the way that this child was attacked and beaten savagely by two other students, but also the way in which a multitude of students at the high school participated by videotaping and cheering on the beating. It is truly something horrific, something that I found horrific. Not to mention the fact that these kids went on to post their videos on social media, adding music, like thug kind of rap music to it, and emojis and horrible comments. So I will be bringing you that story the next time here on A Mexican Crossing Lines. Thanks for being with us tonight to talk about jumping the gun on this gun control debate issue, and for sending us all the information that you had about this and other topics that you want to cover. I will be going back and forth through Black history issues that that intersect in our discussions, like this one. So looking forward to sharing some of the comments that we had with all of the listeners of those shows on our next broadcast with you guys here on A Mexican Crossing Lines. Thank you for being with us today.